Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life, if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, February the 20th, 2025, and I got to tell you, like when we broke into the year 2025 years ago, that sounded a little weird to say it's 2000 and, 2001 and all, and all the way through, like, you just, I don't know, if you were born in the 70s or the 60s or something like that, you kind of marvel at where we're at timeline-wise. But there's something about 2025 that ever since we flipped that switch, I'm like, wow. And I'll tell you what it is. We are one quarter done with a century that most of us saw come, right? Like, when you were a kid, if you were a kid in the 80s, like I was, right? You know, like a teenager in the 80s. Talking about the year 2000 was way out there, man. That was like, oh, one day it'll be, we'll be in flying cars and some bullshit, And like Prince releases like Party Like It's 1999, and that sounded like forever away. And now here we are 25 years past that, a quarter of a century. Tick tock, tick tock. The clock ticks for us all. Get busy doing stuff, man. Get busy with it, because what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to get done with the life that you have, with the dash between that year you were born and the eventual year that you will cease to be here? It's all about moving toward more freedom, independence, and liberty. You're either doing that or you're not. That's how it works. Like, life's not a sliding scale, man. If you are not aggressively pursuing a more liberated life for yourself, life is moving you into a position of more enslavement. I hate putting it that way, but it's true. And we go at this from a variety of things. We don't just talk politics here, even though we do some, because whether you want to be involved in politics or not, it affects us, right? At least some. And the more we do to make it not affect us, the better. So understanding what's going on, it's like knowing a storm's coming. So we talk about that. We also talk about homesteading skills. We talk about things that make your life better and reduce your dependency on the systems. And whenever I say it, I try to make sure I always emphasize the S, the last S in systems, not the first one, the one that makes it plural. It is not the system. The system is an illusion. It is the systems, interlocking loops of systems that control and basically domesticate the human species. If you want to go feral, you've tuned into the right show, thesurvivalpodcast.com. 16 years plus running, we will turn 17 years old this year in June, 3,631 episodes as of today. And what are we going to talk about on our expert panel show for the week? Well, Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams will tell us that firings are good, but if foreign policy of empire remains, we're just spinning our wheels. I like this one. I'll have some add-ons, but I actually am going to bookend this with a similar, the same but different man kind of topic. Joel Riles will talk about dealing with a dog that is aggressive toward other dogs, or my vet refers to this as dog aggressive. Not really for people, just like when it's around another dog, it becomes dog aggressive. Then Carrie Brown will talk to us about Speedwell. What's that? Is it some kind of reloading tool or something? No, it's a plant. The plant is also known as Veronica. It is an herbal remedy for many things. It used to be very popular. Now let's think about the word again. Speed well. To become well quickly, right? There are certain plants, certain herbs that just by knowing their common name, you know that they're medicinal and traditional use. It's also known as Veronica. It's kind of a pretty little plant, too. And Kerry Brown will talk about that. He's also given us a PFAF info link that will go along with it. And then we have Mike Melito, who got just lamb-blasted. I did the math. I said yesterday it might have been six. It was five questions since his last segment that he did on just tactical terms. He's going to talk today about tactical shotguns for home defense. And the person that asked the question may have opened a little tiny can of loving whoop-ass. And well handled out. Dr. Benz will talk about getting medically ready for a trip to Southeast Asia. I gave this one priority because the gentleman that asked the question is fitting to depart, and it'd be good to know the answer before he leaves. So this came in last week, already answered. Ryan Stila, the homestead consultant, will talk about rainwater diverters. This is a very needed discussion, in my opinion, because a lot of people are doing it. And the way you're doing it may be setting you up for trouble, because the most popular way to do it has a lot of potential problems. And I'll tell you what it has to do with, and you'll hear it when he explains it. It has to do with so much of this coming from the tropics and subtropics out of the permaculture world. There are people who think, well, permaculture only works in the tropics. No, you don't understand anything. But a lot of it has, the work has been done in the tropical and subtropical regions of Australia, because that's where kind of the permaculture ground zero, permaculture genesis is from, and some of the most intensive work still being done today that's being published anyway is coming out of the PRI in Australia, and it doesn't freeze there. So while there's another problem with first flush diverters, when you live somewhere it freezes, that can become an even bigger problem. And so Ryan's got some solutions to that for you if you're looking to put in rain catch and you don't want to spend your life doing maintenance to prevent bad problems, because I don't like maintenance any more than is necessary anyway. And the best way to minimize your maintenance is to put the system in from the very beginning designed to do so. And then, speaking of minimizing things, I'm going to ask a question and give you some thoughts on it and some real-world experience with government spending. So DOGE has found billions of dollars in fraud in our government. Do you know what they've done, though? They've looked at printouts. They've looked at printouts, and it's not very hard to look at a printout and says that this money is going to go to a transgendered opera in Ireland, or to provide sex changes in Venezuela, or to promote DEI in Malaysia, and go, yeah, that's something we shouldn't be spending American money on. Personally, I don't think we should be spending much American money outside of America's borders to begin with. But there's another side to this, and it's why they love to throw money into the big misnomer, the NGO hole, and do it out of our country. But it happens in our country too, not just to NGOs, also like for construction projects and things like that. And that is, you throw money at something that sounds good on paper. You notice that, like, a transgendered opera in Ireland, that does not sound like a good place to send your money. But what if we were building critical infrastructure roads for an undeveloped part of the world? Now, you may be like me and think they can build their own roads. But, you know, if you look at that, you could say, well, maybe we disagree about whether or not we should build a road, let's say, in Honduras. But I can at least see that we're actually improving things for people's lives. But what if there's no road at the end of the road? What if we've given money to do something like, you know, roll out broadband internet in America? Well, that sounds like a good, useful thing. But what if there's no broadband internet that's been rolled out? What if we're putting up billions of dollars to put in electric vehicle charging stations and they're not there? These are ones we know about. I want to talk to you today about something called, and I don't even know if this is a real term, I made it up this morning, the terminal end of spending. I'm borrowing that from fishing. In fishing, we have tackle, but some of our tackle is known as terminal tackle. Terminal tackle is what goes on the end of the line. So the fishing reel, the line itself, the piece of it is at the end, but overall, the line is tackle. The rod is tackle. The reel is tackle. The terminal tackle is like the weight, the hook, the bait, the lure. The part that makes contact with the fish. So that's where I'm borrowing the term from. What about the terminal end of spending? Even if we look at something on a piece of paper, and we say, well, even if I disagree, I can understand why some people, at least, some regular, normal people who are not brain damaged, would say, this is a good use of government funds. Or at least, even though I disagree with it, this is a reasonable thing that could be made a case for, even if I disagree with it. And then, but did it happen? What would happen if DOGE expanded to send people out to see where the money's going and see what's actually being done with it? That's an interesting question, and I'll try to tell you what I think we would find out if we did that today. All of that and more in just a minute. Real quick, before we start, remember that the number one way that I keep the lights on, that I pay the bills, that I keep the server running, and I mean, we spend, I think most people don't understand this, like, a podcast our size, we spend a lot of money just on hosting. And the way I pay for it all and then make a living so I can do this every day, so I'm here for you, is by the Member Support Brigade. Without the Member Support Brigade, all the other things we do are not enough to actually sustain what we do and have a good life. So, if you're not a member yet, I really encourage you to consider today becoming a member. If you're a member in the past and you expired, consider becoming a member. And I'm going to do something. I'm going to put the MSB on sale for you guys. You can use the discount code today, and you can use this discount code for the next 14 days, for 2 weeks, and hell, we'll make it 15 days. I'll go to next Friday with this. 15 off now. 15OFFNOW. 15 off now, and it will do exactly what it says. It will give you $15 a year off the MSB that's already a good deal at 50 bucks. 35 bucks for the MSB, and it will lock your recurring rate as well. So if you've been thinking about it or thinking about coming back or something like that, understand, we need that support. And realize it is not PBS. I'm not going to send you a coffee cup worth $5 for your $35, especially a recurring annual charge of $35. No, no, no. I'm going to give you discounts, and I'm telling you that there are discounts in the MSB. If you use them one time, you're covered for the year. I get emails all the time, people telling me they make $300, $400, $500 or more back in their pocket from the discounts, and you'll support the show. I try to do everything from a value for value thing. I'll tell you a quick story before we start today. I've been talking to somebody about some things the business itself, TSP, could do to make more money. And they're pushing me on my coursework toward more and more automation, artificial intelligence and all. And I do use it to produce shows. I do it to produce my coursework, all of that stuff. But I do it through my own self as a filter. And what I said is I will never devalue my audience by taking advantage of them. This is what I have tried to do with this show from day one. There were literally people before I put any monetization into the show that tried to send me money as like a donation. I sent it back. I will not take something for nothing. I will never take from this audience. My belief is that for every dollar I take, I better be giving back $2 in value minimum per person. And if I don't do that, I have dishonored you guys in supporting me all these years. I know people say shit like that, but I mean it. And I'm hoping my track record now for almost 17 years has demonstrated that. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams today. Firings are good, but if a foreign policy empire remains, are we just spinning our wheels?
Yeah, I mean, once upon a time, not that long ago, we would have had the left with us on this. They would be cheering. Oh, they're cutting it to Pentagon. We never thought that would happen. That's a good thing. Now, there still are a lot of good progressives, people like our good friend Dennis Kucinich, who's on our board, a lot of good people like that who are cheering this. But by and large, sadly enough, the Democratic Party is not cheering it because they've become the war party. We'll put that first clip on. This is from Hedgegan today. This is what we noticed. Incoming, DOGE poised to strike Defense Department with mass layoffs. And we've seen, here's the Grim Reaper. He was at Energy. He was at Interior. And now he's knocking on DOD's door. It is very, very heartwarming in a way. And the thing is, as you sort of suggested in your intro, Dr. Paul, yes, firing a few people may not be the big money, the big thing that we need. But as you suggested with USAID, yes, they save money by stopping the spending. But they also revealed to the world the things that were being done with the money that were actually very harmful. Now, they revealed a worldwide matrix of fake newspapers, fake media. They were all supposed to be independent voices. They were all subsidized by the U.S. government, and they were saying just what their masters wanted them to say. So I think the same thing could happen at the Pentagon, even if they don't do the kinds of cuts that we want, and they may do those. We may start finding out the kinds of things that were done with that money simply by looking at what things they can't do anymore and realize, and Americans may realize, well, hang on, that wasn't defending America. That was doing all sorts of other things. So I think that's the real benefit of this.
I think it's good that they're mentioning this. But I was surprised at how many choices, hundreds of thousands of people, yeah. 950,000 civilian employees in all in the Pentagon.
Amazing, amazing.
Boy, so we will see. I think it's going to be tough, but I'll tell you what, the people who are involved in being attacked by Musk, they're scared. They know it's serious, and it may well be, but it'll be a PR fight is what I think will happen. You know, who gets the most sympathy? But it's still good news that this is the most confrontational and, available to people to see what's happening and seeing, why haven't they done this years ago?
Yeah.
So let's encourage them to continue.
It would be nice that if these jobs were made redundant because we changed our policies, and therefore these people are no longer needed because we don't do these things anymore. We bring all the troops home. We close all the bases overseas. We stop funding 60 or 70% of NATO and get out of NATO. Stop doing all of these regime changes using our military. Stop training the militaries of other countries so that we can rely on them if we need a coup. Stop doing all these things and then take a look at the Pentagon and say, well, we're not doing all this dumb stuff that we used to do, so let's get rid of people. But we also have to live in the real world, and we know that there's a narrow window of opportunity to really strike radically, and we're in it right now because it will end, and they won't be able to do it later.
So I actually think we are going to see quite a bit of empire curtailing. I honest to God believe that the way that Trump had to build the coalition to become the president again has changed a lot of things about how and what he will do. The thing about Trump that's good and bad is he tends to side with whoever talks to him last, as long as they are at least in his wheelhouse of basic principles and what they say is logical and makes sense. And this is why it's imperative for him to have people around him that won't just kiss his ass. It's imperative for him to have people around him that think differently than Washington has. And it's imperative that he know that's what he's done. And he's got a huge ego. I mean, the man has a massive fucking ego. And what happened to him, I think, made him have to make deals with people that I don't know that he would have made deals with if he had just gotten reelected the first time, like Elon Musk. I don't know if Elon Musk would have been ready to do business with Trump this way, you know, in 2020 either. I think a lot of things had to happen. It seems fortuitous or destined that we are where we are. And I'm not invoking like some real spiritual thing or anything like that. I think that eventually, when we behave the way we've behaved for so long as a country, not individually as people, there has to be a reckoning. And that reckoning can be really, really horrible, or it can be less bad, less painful, and more productive, and we can recover from that reckoning quicker. That feels like what's happening. I'm not calling off the alarm or anything. I'm just saying that feels like where we're going. And I think that when you get a guy like Elon Musk, who has spent his whole life looking at numbers more than anything else, and you get a guy like Trump who has spent his whole life looking at numbers more than anything else, you put those two heads together and you start peeling this back and really looking at it, I think there is more of an understanding like something has to give, and what should give isn't the things that make us an empire, right? That's what should give, the things that make us an empire. The things that are not directly making life better in America for Americans, all this indirect regime change bullshit. The EU just started saying shit when J.D. Vance went over there and said, hey, you know, maybe y'all should look at like how you're censoring free speech, and are you really being the democracy example for the world? And they had a tantrum. We have provided everything for these people for 75 years. For 75 years, we've carried their weight with NATO, with defending their countries, with allowing them to spend shitloads of money on socialist bullshit because they didn't have to spend the money defending their own borders in a place that's had to deal with war a hell of a lot more than we do over here. We are in a very defensible position in North America. We could tell the rest of the world to go get effed. Choose who we do business with and how, and just be what some people would call isolationist. I don't think that's isolationist. Isolationist is we don't care about you. What I'm talking about is being non-interventionist, which is we'll do business with you. We'll have trade with you. We'll have discussions with you. We're not going to put boots on the ground in your ground. We're not doing it. So Europe said maybe we should just defend ourselves. Oh, do not tempt us with a good time. You think Trump's cutting? There'd be bases closing around the world today if I was president. I'm telling you right now. And I would start in Europe and the Middle East. Those are the first places I would start removing American bases. And I bet you'd see how quick all that shit talk turned around. Go figure out how much of the German economy is being supported directly and indirectly by U.S. military bases in Germany. Go see how many jobs that is. Go see what a hit that would be to their GDP. Let alone the fact that now they can spend less money on their own defense. Yeah. I think we have only just begun, and I'll say more about that in my piece at the end. Now let's talk about dogs. And having a dog that becomes aggressive toward other dogs, and it being even worse. It's one thing when a dog is aggressive towards other dogs, and when you go somewhere, there's another dog, and your dog wants to fight with the dog. Okay, it sucks, but it's a reasonable thing. Like, I'll just keep my dog away from your dog, and you should listen and keep your dog away from mine. But what if they're your own dogs? You own both of them. That's what's going on here. Joel will talk about it.
Hello, TSP Land. This is Joel Riles with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy, coming back to you with another expert counsel question. And today's question is from Cynthia, and she has a situation where there is an older dog and there is a younger dog. And the younger dog, I believe, has just turned about 1 year old and is starting to act aggressively toward the older dog, which, of course, they've had for a longer period of time. But he's kind of getting on his last legs. And she wants to know, how does she deal with this, especially since the aggression only occurs occasionally? So, the bottom line is, whenever you have a problem situation with a dog, the only way to fix it is to recreate the problem. And so you have to recreate the problem and then correct the dog for doing the problem, right? Dogs are not like humans where you can sit down and have a conversation. Remember last week you did this? That really upset me. I don't want you to do it again. Obviously, dogs can't have that kind of conversation. So what you have to do is you have to either watch, or what I like to do is I deliberately create the situation. Now, of course, depending on the situation you're creating, there may need to be safety measures put in place, right? If a dog barks at my children, I'm not just going to say, run up to the dog and let me see what he does again. Right? I'm going to set up safety measures where I make sure that if a situation occurs again, my child's not getting bit by my dog, right? So this may be a situation where you do want to have a couple of safety measures. However, essentially, here's what we need to do. We need to recreate the problem. So the problem in this case is her dog is becoming somewhat territorial slash aggressive toward the older dog, right? This is a similar situation to what we will talk about with our clients. If they call and they want a protection dog, but they let us know, hey, I already have a dog. Can I also bring this protection dog into our family without having an issue? The answer I always give them is, as long as the dog you already have is fair to the new dog that's coming in, then you won't have any issues. Our dogs are not aggressive toward other dogs. So as long as the dog you already have isn't the one causing the problem, you won't have any issues. Now, I have had some clients who have had dogs that their dog is the problem when they get a dog from us, right? And so my general perspective on this is I would not allow one of my children to bully and push around another child, maybe roughhouse sometimes and things like that. But if there's one that's obviously being pushed around and the other one's being the problem child, I'm going to correct that. And so to me, this is a situation where I go, it's unacceptable for a dog to be acting that way toward another dog. And so we need to fix it. And in order to fix it, we have to recreate the problem. So here's what I would do. And if you need more details on this or more questions, it's okay, baby. Leave it alone. If you need more details on this, you can contact me directly, joel@fortresscanine.com, because there may be some level of detail that we haven't addressed here. Fooey it, plus. We have some children playing on the road out in front of us, and my dog is warning me that they're out there. Okay, so here's what I would do. I would have some kind of correction collar. In my particular situation, I would recommend using a prong collar with a good durable lead, or leash, if you want to call it that. And I would have the lead on the dog connected to the prong collar, and I would set up situations where the dog may potentially act aggressive toward the other dog. Now, one of two things is going to happen when you set these situations up. Either the dog's going to act aggressively, in which case I give a firm and a serious correction. Typically, I don't string a dog up initially unless they continue to ramp it up themselves. But what I will do is something like a pow, pow with the lead, right? A good, solid, hard pop pop correction, along with a chastising tone in my voice. Knock that off. Booey that. That's not acceptable. And then as soon as it's over and as soon as they're calm and they stop, that's all you have to do, girl. Good job. So some people have said it actually sounds like you're kind of schizophrenic when you do this, because you have to get serious when there's a serious situation. But then as soon as that situation is over, in the dog's world, it's over. And if you keep holding a grudge once they've stopped doing the problem behavior, they're like, but I thought that would make you happy if I stopped doing the behavior. Right? So as soon as they stop the behavior, you have to be happy. And you have to let them know, good job. That's all you had to do is be a good girl or good boy, and then I won't correct you anymore for that kind of stuff, right? So you need both of these things to go together. You need the praise when they do what you want, but you also need the serious correction and the chastising tone. I'm very, very unhappy with you when they're doing the thing that they're not supposed to do. You want to make sure when you set these situations up that whoever is the one with the lead, number one, is strong enough to give the correction that's needed. And number two, if there's a lunging situation where the more aggressive dog lunges toward the other, they need to be paying attention and on alert so that they can keep there from being a dog fight type of situation, right? Just in case. Or the other dog just getting injured, even if it wouldn't fight back. Now, you can set these situations up in a couple different ways. I can put the older dog on the couch next to one of you and then walk the younger dog up. And as they get closer, I'm keeping a really close eye. If there's any growling, if there's any barking, if there's any negative behavior at all, right? The bristling on the shoulder blades or the tail going straight up in the air, any of those behaviors, I'm going to correct that dog. Now, here's the other part of this, and this is very important. If you know dogs have an issue that's repetitive with a certain thing that leads up to it, right? So it could be every time we walk up to the house, my dog does XYZ and I don't like it. Every time, you know, my dog walks near the trash can, it does something that I don't like. If there's a thing that every time you do the thing with your dog, they do a thing you don't like, well, then when you approach that thing, expect that they're going to do the behavior you don't like and be ready to communicate and correct it. Now, here's the thing I want to do is I want to tell the dog before we get there, don't do that thing. Right now, okay, so let's say it's an aggression issue. As I'm approaching the scenario, the situation, so I'm the one with the dog that acts aggressive sometimes. The other dog is on the couch with my wife, let's say, and I'm approaching them. I'm going to look down at the dog that I have, and I'm going to say, it's okay, leave it alone. So what I told the dog is, I see what's there in front of us, leave it alone, do not react to it. And then I'm going to walk up, and if they react, I'm going to correct them hard, just like I said, and I'm going to say, I said leave it. I'm going to turn around and walk away a little bit, and I'm going to turn around and walk back. And if they act again, I'm going to correct harder. Fooey it, I said leave it. I'm going to turn around and walk away, I'm going to walk back. And I'm going to do it until I get a successful approach. And when I get a successful approach, I'm going to go, oh, atta girl, good job. Assuming it's a female, right? Atta boy. Oh, you did so good. Good, leave it. Good, leave it. That's all you had to do was leave it alone. And then it's done for about 10, 15 minutes or maybe even the next day. Right? And then I'm going to create the situation again. I'm going to create the situation again. I'm going to give gaps in between, though, because these situations, the dog is barking or growling for some reason. We don't know what that reason is specifically, but it could be that the dog is stressed. So if I keep introducing the situation, I can keep building that stress up too high. So I don't want to build the stress too high, but I do want them to know, I'm not asking you to not be aggressive. You will not be aggressive toward this other dog, or it's going to go very badly for you. And you have to make it go badly enough that they do not want to be aggressive anymore for whatever the situation is. And I hope that's helpful for you. Remember, be very careful so that you or the other dog doesn't get injured in these situations. That will all vary depending on how aggressive the dog is being, why they're being aggressive, things like that. And again, if you need more help with specifics, you can send me an email. Please put like question in all caps in the subject line so it catches my attention. But I would be happy to help you work through that in a little bit more detail. All right, I hope that's been helpful for you guys. Remember, if you need help training your dog, you can always check out Canine Academy. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on the Canine Academy banner up there on the right-hand side. If you are looking to purchase a protection dog or a working line German Shepherd, Dutch Shepherd, or Malinois puppy, go check out Fortress Canine, and or you can always email me at joel@fortresscanine.com. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
In the end, it's always the same thing. It's always the same thing. Create the problem. Control the problem so that it does not go bad. And then correct the behavior to condition the response. This is how, and Joel and I broke it down that way together about 2 years ago on a whiteboard. But in the end, we just made something memorable that every good dog trainer does one way or another. When the dog understands this is bad and I get a correction for it, and this is good and I get rewarded for it, things turn around really quick. But here's one thing I want to just point out about any of these training methods. Sometimes it seems like it takes forever, it takes forever, it takes forever, it takes forever, it takes... Boom! It just happens. You know, we had an issue with Belle, and I got Belle from Joel. When she first got here, I could walk her around the ducks, and she never chased them or anything. And somewhere in that puppy development head, that prey drive kicked in, and it was a pain in the ass for about 6 months. Now I can take her out to the coop, sit her in front of the coop, open the door, and the ducks fly around her. She doesn't flinch. It takes time, and then it's fast. It's gradually, then suddenly, right? And it's worth the effort. Now let's hear about Speedwell, which is a medicinal herb from Kerry Brown.
Hey, TSP. Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast. Got a question today on budget home defense shotguns. Now, Taylor, I'm going to be real with you, and it might be a tough pill to swallow. But if I didn't care, I wouldn't bother. You asked me for my advice on a budget shotgun, then you proceed to tell me what you've already done. And what you've done to me seems like a tactical abomination. You got a cheap Chinese copy of a Remington 870, and then proceeded by your own estimation to put $650 worth of accessories on it. I'm not going to list all the specifics of stuff that he's put on here. He says at the end of his lengthy email, all told, I'm looking at $650 just worth of accessories added to a $200 shotgun. That may not fit under budget friendly for a lot of people, but I consider it a decent deal considering the quality of components and that a person could spend $850 on just the shotgun very easily. Taylor, here's what I'm going to tell you. You would have been better off spending the money on a shotgun. One of the things that makes shotguns, especially pump shotguns, great for this is they are simple and they are affordable. You would have been better off getting a decent shotgun and just putting a white light on it. For that amount of money, you could have gotten a really good Mossberg 500 or 590, or you could have gotten a Benelli Nova, a fine pump-action shotgun, instead of a shotgun of dubious quality, a, you know, Wish.com 870 or a hashtag Me2 tactical shotgun that may or may not work for who knows how long. I'm going to hit you with a pretty easy movie reference, then a bit of an analogy. You ever see the Indiana Jones movie where they're looking for the Holy Grail, and the one guy picks a really fancy cup with all the stuff on it, and he drinks it and quickly dies, and the knight says, he chose poorly. Now, we've all done this. We've all had, like, gun purchase hangovers. Another analogy would be you get a Geo Metro for $800. That's what it is, kind of an old beater junker car. You get it for $800. Barely runs. Maybe it runs on a good day. On 72 degrees and sunny day, it'll run. It'll get you to the store and back. You proceed to throw a $3,000 paint job on it, and you buy a Lamborghini hood ornament and a spoiler and a bunch of other stuff that you put on this car. Now, if you're the guy's buddy looking at this, like, whatever. If he's going to drive this thing to, if people still go to the malls anymore, if he's driving it to the mall to go out, park outside the food court and try to impress some ladies, you're like, whatever, he's not hurting anything. Worst comes to worst, he might embarrass himself if the car doesn't work. It'd kind of be like if you were taking this shotgun to the range to, like, show off how tactical it is. Maybe you'd get embarrassed when it malfunctioned and broke in front of everybody, but nobody's really going to get hurt. You're talking about this for a home defense gun. This would be like if that same buddy, if you were sitting there watching that same buddy with that car, and he's convinced himself that it's an actual race car, and he's going to go to the local drag strip and take the deed to his house and put it up for collateral in a race because he's convinced himself it's just as good as a Porsche. Dire consequences could come from this. This is when you as a buddy might step in and be like, hey, man, I got to try to intervene here. That's me with you right now, buddy. I got to try and intervene here. Remington 870 is a fine shotgun. The older ones are really, really good shotguns, some of the best. New Remington, when they had their bankruptcy thing and came out, I was like, oh, I'm going to get a new 870, try and support Remington, American-made company, a classic. I love 870s, use them as a police officer. I went out and bought a brand new one. It didn't run. It wasn't reliable. And that's Remington made in America by Remington because they had a slip in their quality control. And I'm not the only one. That's pretty common for the new Remingtons. I can't recommend them. If a Remington made in America for way more money has a hard time making a reliable 870, what do you think that hashtag MeToo Chinese copy is going to do? And you're talking about for home defense. The good news is the accessories you listed up. Kind of baffled me because accessories are pretty nice high-end accessories. You can get a really good shotgun. You could, you know, keep that shotgun for a fun gun for a, I know it's a gun's not a toy, but a range toy for lack of a better term. Keep that for that. I'm going to end with the first part of your question. What do I recommend for a budget home defense shotgun? Get a Mossberg 500. I routinely go into Walmart. See, Mossberg 500s, not even the Maverick 88, but the Mossberg 500s, 12-gauge, 20-gauge, good all-around shotgun for $250, under $300 all day long. 12-gauge, 20-gauge, take your pick. They are not just good budget shotguns. They're some of the most legendarily reliable repeating firearms ever made by human beings, and they're $250, $300. Get one of those, put a white light on it, and that's really all you need. That's one of the beautiful things about shotguns. Maybe you want to put a sling on it. Go crazy. Put a sling on it. Because especially with the money you spent on this thing, you could get a Benelli Nova. I don't want to be a tactical snob and say that, you know, if you don't have a Benelli M4 for $2,000, you're wrong. But a Benelli Nova is not very expensive compared to what you've got into the shotgun. And that's something that'll last for generations, much like the Mossberg 500, 590. You could even get into a 590. With a light for what you paid for that. And if you want to go even cheaper, the Maverick 88. I would still recommend a Maverick 88. There can be had, I think, even in gunflation post-COVID money for under $200. And those are slightly cheaper, but still really good, domestically manufactured. Yes, they are still American-made. They're a cheaper variant of the Mossberg 500, but they're crazy reliable, American-made, rugged. Take a Maverick 88 with a white light on it, all day over a cheap Chinese copy of an 870 with a bunch of accessories you probably don't need on there. So my recommendation, Maverick 88, if that's all you can afford, with a white light, fine. A little bit more money, Mossberg 500, a little bit more than that, a 590 if you're going just straight for the not crossover hunting, but just straight tactical. And or find an older, like pre their bankruptcy, older 870. There's a lot of those, and those aren't a lot of money. I would certainly rather have a used 87, older 870 than a cheap Chinese copy. I hope that helps. I'm mean because I care. Appreciate you guys, and have a blessed day.
Nothing to say there, but yep. Anyway, moving on, let's now talk about getting ready to go on a trip to Southeast Asia from a medical perspective with Old Dog Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week we have a question from CJ, who writes, are there any immunizations or medical procedures I should get done here in the States before going on a multi-month backpacking trip to Southeast Asia? Here's the details. I'm not a big fan of jabby jabs, but try to be pragmatic. I'll be staying at hostels, campgrounds, and hotels in Thailand, Laos, and Burma. I think Burma is called Myanmar now. While visiting their mountains, rainforests, and beaches. Wow, nice. With 2 months to go, I'm all caught up on dental work and have my yearly physical scheduled for 2 weeks before departure. I'm just wondering if you can advise anything on the medical side to bring up to my MD. Thanks so much. Wow, CJ, what an adventure. Asia has many beautiful and interesting areas to visit, and it's going to be certainly a memorable experience, but there are a number of endemic diseases for which you have to watch out. An endemic disease is one that's habitually seen in a particular region. Vaccines are a touchy subject these days, for sure, but there are certainly risks of disease transmission in the type of long-term trip to exotic places that you're contemplating. Your doctor will most likely follow CDC recommendations, which are guidelines for what routine vaccinations they feel you should have had in the past, and what special vaccinations are given for those traveling to where you're going. It'll be somewhat similar to what happens when you enter the military. The CDC recommends the following vaccinations for travelers to East and Southeast Asia: hepatitis A, hepatitis B, typhoid, cholera, yellow fever, Japanese encephalitis, rabies, and polio. I see they don't mention malaria, which also might be common. Equally recommended options for malaria prevention include chloroquine, etavaquone or proguanil, doxycycline for adults, and mefloquine. Primaquine is used in areas where there's a particular type of malarial organism known as Plasmodium vivax. So research into that. It's possible you may have had one or the other of these immunizations in the past. If so, ask your doctor if they recommend a booster. Additionally, the list of routine vaccines given to most Americans includes measles, mumps, and rubella, tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, influenza, chickenpox, shingles, if you're a certain age, pneumococcal pneumonia, also if you're a certain age, and meningitis. Then, of course, there's COVID and respiratory syncytial virus, which form, along with influenza, the tridemic of respiratory diseases that we've seen seasonally in the last few years. That's a lot of jabs, so make sure you do your own research and come to your own conclusions. Vaccines are usually safe, but a percentage of people will have problems. I know about this personally, so know what you're getting into. Given that you're backpacking, it suggests that you might be in the backcountry where food preparation and water disinfection might be iffy. The cities, which will be crowded, might not be much better, however, and exposes you to many more people that can transmit diseases. Consider asking your doctor for a course of antibiotic, or maybe two, to take with you, just in case. Say something like doxycycline. You never know when it'll come in handy. Flagyl is another good option. CJ, I wish you a safe and healthy journey. I'll tell you, I'm an old man now, and I no longer have the desire nor the ability to hit the road to new and strange lands. I can only say that after this trip, you'll never have to prove your courage in any other way. I admire you for it, and best of luck. This is Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. And get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
I'll just say most of these vaccines I wouldn't do. I just wouldn't. Most of them don't do shit. Most of them, if they're for childhood illnesses as an adult, you don't need them anymore. Even the ones that work, like MMR. The one that I would maybe consider, especially, and you might have a very hard time finding a doctor to give it to you without a bunch of other bullshit, like a three for one jab, is I might really consider, if I was going deep into the rainforest and things like that, if this was a real nature-seeking thing, is tetanus. Tetanus is no joke, and tetanus shots after the injury are to make you feel good. They don't do anything, because the tetanus shot has a delay between the injection and the development of the antibodies. And it is one of the vaccines, and it's a very old one, that has saved many, many lives for real. If you go back and you look at deaths, for instance, during World War I, there's probably more deaths from tetanus and other illnesses than there are from things like bullets, at least directly from bullets. So some of those injuries may have involved bullets, but and the conditions were awful. The only thing I'm overstating, I mean, being in these trenches, getting trench foot, having all this bacteria basically being incubated like a petri dish, and it was just awful. But it does show you that that is a true life-threatening illness, and it would be one that I would look at. Flu shots are bullshit. They don't do anything. The COVID jab is crap. If you get that at this point, you need your head examined. Like, now, I will say things like hydroxychloroquine. If you're going to a place with malaria exposure, yes, please. And you might even use it as an excuse to try to get a little bit extra because it has other valuable things. This is a good thing to discuss with your doctor. And then, you know, when they start telling you need like 87 vaccinations, you can just say, I'll take that under advisement. Give me these two. Honest to God, that's just how I personally feel. Again, though, I'm not a doctor. I'm just somebody that pays attention. Next up today, let's talk about rainwater collection and diverting debris diversion for rainwater catchment, and why the first flush system that is so popular and really came out of the permaculture space heavily may not be the one that you need to be using.
Hey, Jack and TSP community, this is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I've got a question about rainwater diverters and what I recommend for rainwater diverters. And I actually have two that I've been very happy with, and I will leave links for Jack so that people can look them up and see what they think for themselves. And I'm going to kind of describe what the best situations are to use each one and why you would want to use one over the other. And I also want to talk a little bit about a rainwater diverter system that I think is not appropriate for at least the majority of the people who would be listening to this podcast. So I'm actually going to start there. Most of you have probably heard of the first flush system, which are a really cool rainwater collection system, but they were designed for subtropical and tropical regions where you get either no freezing or very, very little freezing. And because of that, there are some major downsides to the first flush system that you can run into, as well as just some general design flaws or issues that make it so that I don't typically recommend them. So basically, a first flush system is a tube off of your diverter that catches the first amount of water off your roof. That first amount of water is then held and slowly dripped out through a drain in that tube. And that's so you don't get debris and other things from the roof when you first get, well, the first flush off of the roof. And in that sense, they're a great design and a great idea. Here's where you run into an issue. That pipe that holds the water, that first flush from the system, is going to have a small outlet hole, and that hole is actually very easy to clog. And since that pipe is intended to catch debris and other things running off of the roof, that hole tends to clog with debris quite quickly and quite easily. So it becomes a high maintenance item. That's bad enough as it is, but given that if you're using the system in a freezing area or in a temperate area where you'll get freezes, oftentimes what will happen is during the day, things will get warm enough, like snow on your roof will get warm enough that it melts, goes down the gutters and into the downspout and then into the first flush system. And if that first flush system is clogged, it will back up and stay in there. And when it freezes at night, it will freeze that system and basically destroy it. And so you'll be constantly replacing your first flush system, or at least that tube, if you're not extremely vigilant on maintenance or taking it apart anytime you think there might be a freeze. So that's typically why I don't recommend the first flush system that is actually quite popular in permaculture, is because I don't think it's really appropriate for a temperate area where you get consistent freezing. So my alternatives to that are a system called the Mondulin Smart Filter. This is actually a recommendation from Sean Mills. And after I got my hands on one and did my first install, I realized that it was not only significantly better than the first flush systems, that it's actually also better at general filtration and should allow for basically the same amount of water capture as a well-built first flush system. So my two downsides with this diverter are, one, that it's actually fairly difficult to install. It requires a decent amount of essentially plumbing and adapting to make it work properly. So that's one issue that I have with it. The other is that it's pretty expensive. Generally, you can find them for between $250 and $300, which is fairly expensive per downspout. So keep that in mind. It's a great filter. It's by far my favorite, but it is a bit expensive. Basically, you're going to want to use that for any collection system that's probably anywhere from 750 to, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 gallons or more. And then for anything that's less than that, so 700 or less, I actually recommend a downspout diverter by Catch a Raindrop Flex Drain is what it's called. This is a very simple, very inexpensive, I think around $15 or $20 downspout diverter. It has become one of my favorites because of its simplicity for both connection and installation. All you have to do is cut your downspout, and this slips in where you cut the downspout, and you basically slip the downspout back in it, and it just works. It has a 1-inch outlet that can be adapted, and you can adapt it to a hose or to PVC quite easily. I've been really happy with these. The downside to these is that they have a lot less filtration than the Mondulin system, and that they are capable of less flow. So if you get a really hard rain, you will not collect all of the water because the outlet is a 1-inch outlet, which is going to reduce your fill of the tank. So keep that in mind. It's a lot less expensive. It's very easy to install, and it works great, but it doesn't filter quite as well, and it doesn't fill your tanks quite as quickly. A few additional considerations on rainwater diverters that I like to mention is, one, generally speaking, you want to install the diverter as high on your downspouts as possible. Most diverters that you buy will actually give you instructions to install the diverter right next to, say, a rain barrel. But if you install it higher and run your pipe down to what you're trying to fill, not only will it fill faster because you'll actually get a bit of a suction effect in the pipe because of the height of the downspout diverter and the length of the pipe from that height, but you will also have the ability to run that pipe further. Another consideration is to install leaf guards on your gutters. That will really reduce the amount of debris and things that end up in your water system. And the last consideration is, when you install these systems, you want to make sure to have an overflow for your tank. And you want to make sure that that overflow is just low enough so that water doesn't back up your fill pipe. So if you're using PVC as a fill pipe from the rainwater diverter to your tank, and your overflow is not low enough on the tank, what will happen is that water will back up into that pipe, and it will actually freeze and cause damage, and you'll be doing constant maintenance because of that. So consider your overflow into that tank as well. Well, that pretty much wraps it up for my segment. If you are needing to get a hold of me or find my information, you can find everything on me at thehomesteadconsultant.com, or you can also look up my videos on YouTube. Just type in The Homestead Consultant and you'll find me pretty quickly. I've got a ton of evergreen content that's free to help you on your homestead journey. And until next time, get your hands dirty and go get some things done.
And I do have links to all of the stuff that Ryan mentioned, and there was an earlier segment that we had by Kerry Brown on Speedwell, and there's a PFAF info link in the show notes as well for both of those segments. And I'll tell you, the PFAF stuff is a hell of a resource. It stands for Plants for a Future, and it basically has profiles of almost every plant that there is that is in any way useful for humans. And you can find that website at pfaf.org. And you can spend a lot of time on that site learning a lot of things. I would just tell you that. All right, with that, let's go ahead and let's get into my segment. I just want to kind of bounce an idea off of people as we're looking at all this fraud from the Doge folks and the work that they're doing, which I think is exceptional, by the way. This is not really a complaint. It's just, but have you thought about going at another level here? So it's real easy when Doge goes into like USAID, and just to be clear on this, it's important that people understand this. Elon and these autistic hackers of his, they are not going in there with full access to these databases and just starting to pull their own data and make changes and cuts and all. That's not how this works at all. There are employees in these organizations that are being tasked with cooperating with DOGE, and when they don't, they get fired, and the next person gets an opportunity to do it. And they are actually collecting and compiling the data and providing it to DOGE. And I think even with that, there is the potential that some of the shit that maybe those individuals want to hide is being hidden. But that's not even what I want to talk about. So when they get these printouts and they see something like, you know, trillions of dollars that were spent in the overriding payment system that with that no coding whatsoever, that's really easy to go, something's wrong here. But when there is a line item for it, and it, like I said, it's a transgendered opera in Ireland, and that's a real thing. And it wasn't a huge amount of money, but how much money from American taxpayers should go to a transgendered opera in Ireland? The answer is zero. If you're not, if you didn't instantly think zero, then you probably should turn this off right now and not listen to the rest of it, because you're really not going to like where it goes from here. I bet maybe one person turned it off that listened this long, if that. But when it's, you know, for sex changes in Colombia, or it's for DEI initiatives in Malaysia or something, it's really easy to go, this is bad. But I'll tell you what, I guarantee you there's a ton of shit in there that sounds like it's a good thing, you know, like a charity that's supposed to help children, for instance, domestically or foreign. Again, you may be like me and think the foreign aid, we need to just cut it off. None. Zero. Zilch. Absolutely no money to any country outside of our own borders until we are at least 50%, you know, halfway fixed of our problems that we have right now. Like, when we have almost nobody living on the street except for the people that legitimately are choosing to live on the street because they won't give up their drugs in return for help, like, when that's the only homeless people that we have, and when even those people have an option to help get themselves off the drugs and off the street, okay. When we don't have people having their homes foreclosed on because they're old and retired and they don't really owe any money on their homes, but they can't afford their property taxes anymore, when all of that kind of shit can at least be halfway addressed, maybe we can help somebody like in Canada or Mexico and start with our neighbors the way that we all should with our private charity. Fix your own house, then worry about your neighbors, then worry about your city, then worry about your county, then worry about your state, then worry about your country, then worry about outside your country. It's really what we should do. And I see it. The thing is, it's so pervasive, it's been passed down, this idea that you need to go far away to help somebody, that I even see schools doing, churches doing it. One of my relations, they're my nephew and my niece, so my brother and sister-in-law, they're very involved with their church. It's a great church, Methodist church. But what do? They have mission trips for the kids. They all load them up in a van and they drive way out to West. At least they're in the same state, but they're way out in West Texas, you know, building housing for people and stuff. And that's great, but I think there's some people right here in Tarrant County that could use your help. Why are you going so far away? Why don't you help right in your own backyard? Because then you could see if the effort you applied actually spurred fruit. And if it did, you do more of that. And if it does, if it falls on the ungrateful, you stop doing it and you move it somewhere else. If what you did then gets abused, you move it to somewhere else. And this is the problem I want to talk about. What if DOGE, once they get done raking through all the paperwork and cutting the obvious, sent out teams to simply say, what are you doing at the terminal end of spending? Like I said, thinking like fishing, the hook, the bait, and the weight. That's the terminal tackle. That's what actually connects to the fish. What happens where the money goes to the ground? How much is lost along the way, by the way? Like, how many people take some of the money on the way down the line in the forms of salaries and overhead and all this other bullshit? And we know that number is a base. In many government departments, it's 60%. In other words, USAID has taken 60% of the money they give away before it even leaves the house. It's ridiculous. But okay, 40% of billions of dollars is still billions of dollars. Okay? What's happening at the terminal end? And I'll point out what I mean this way. I'll tell you about a project our government did where I can say for a fact that at least what we said we were doing got done. Now, how efficiently it was done, I can't tell you. Efficiency on the ground was pretty good. I was in the Army, 1992, deployed to Honduras in a place called the Aguan River Valley as part of something called Fortis Caminos, which is strong roads. And this was a project throughout Central America with nations at least somewhat friendly to the United States to put in roads, bridges, and schools in Honduras. Now, I'm not saying we should have been doing that. I'm saying that we were, and I was the mechanic fixing the trucks and the equipment that was putting the road in. So at the end of the day, we put in a road through one of the most harsh regions of the world, and when we left, there was a road there. And so the road didn't get washed away immediately. We put in a whole bunch of culverts to move the water under the road instead of across the road. And at the end of the day, the United States government, back in the 1990s, not that long ago, said, we need to help these people in this rural part of the world to develop. And we know to develop, you need roads. And so we're going to go put a road in. And 6 months later, when we left, there was a road. How many places was there supposed to be a road that there is no road? I mean, I can just think of some things from like the stimulus program under Obama where some of it happened, but what happened to the rest of the money? And I'm not talking about all the money they gave to a fake solar company. That's another can of worms. I'm talking about something like this. There was a place where they decided they're going to put a dam in, put in because water is an important resource. As much as I hate the government and as much as I know that people could do it better in the private system, okay, you're going to put in water? Okay. I can get on board with that. Lakes benefit everybody. You've got a recreational use. They spur commerce. You know, you have a water resource. You can use them to irrigate crops. You can use them to provide water to people's houses. Like, there's a lot of benefit to a lake. So they're going to put the dam in. It's not a huge dam, but it was like a $100 million project. Well, somebody, when they were putting the project in, said, well, if there's going to be a dam here, and this road goes by where this dam's going to be, if somebody goes off that road, they'll fall in the water and drown, and we don't want that. So part of the dam project is we need a guardrail. Well, that seems perfectly reasonable that we would have a guardrail. Okay, guardrails are not a complicated piece of infrastructure. You've seen them all the time. You basically put some posts in the ground and you bolt some galvanized things to them, and these are all mass-produced products. They spent $9 million on the guardrail. Here's the good news, sort of. They actually built the guardrail. Now, when you look at it, and I couldn't find it if I tried today. This was a long time ago. This is 15, 14 years ago, and it's not the kind of thing people really want you to remember, so I'd have to look really hard. But when you look at it, you go, I don't understand how it took $9 million to build that. But let's just say that it did. Do you know what the real problem is? They never built the frickin' dam. They spent $9 million on a guardrail to keep people from going into an impoundment that they never then built. Okay, all I'm suggesting is in addition to things like having a bunch of Social Security collection still on the books where people would be 150 years old, and we can look at that and all agree there's no way that makes sense. Maybe we should be looking at, and of the Social Security numbers that are drawn Social Security where a check's going out and it's being cashed, how many of them are being cashed by people who are like grandchildren and children of that person, and that person is dead? And I'm just betting you that number's fairly high. I'm going to tell you something. This happens all the time. Betty's living in a single-wide trailer. She's an old lady. She worked her whole life. She's got a few, you know, like $1,200 coming into Social Security. And her parasitic grandson, who's a black sheep of the family, she takes him in. He lives there. She dies. He doesn't really care, except grandma's gone. He does the very minimum he has to. He doesn't go out of his way. It fails to get reported to the federal government that Betty's dead. He has access to her bank account because she did that so he could pay bills and stuff. And the check comes and he says, well, fuck it. Maybe she has one. And it goes on 10, 15 years. And Stu the dirtbag is living in Betty's old paid-for single-wide trailer off her Social Security money. This is happening. And if you start talking about that, you'll, don't touch my Social Security from the boomers. Shut up. The reason the fund that pays you is going broke is because of things like 150-year-olds drawing checks, people drawing checks in fucking Europe, okay, and all around the world where they shouldn't be, and people like, you know, Cletus the dirtbag that's collecting a check on somebody who's been dead for 10 or 15 years and don't think it's not happening. And that is just one form of fraud. So what I'm saying is we need to be looking at the fraud at multiple levels, starting at the top, which is what Elon and his autistic brigade are doing. That's great. But if you don't start looking deeper, especially, okay, the things I'm talking about are mostly domestic. They're easy to look at. What about a program that's for building, you know, roads in northern Vietnam where they need some roads built? And again, you and I can say, I don't think we should pay for that. Okay, fine. But at least it's a road. Like, as if I put it on my anger scale, it's not a 10, right? Performing sex changes on orphans in Japan, which probably wouldn't happen, orphans in Cambodia. Okay, that is an anger quotient of a 10 and a 1 to 10. Building a road, if you actually build the road in northern Vietnam to help rural people like the project I was on in Honduras in the 90s, that's an anger level of about a 3 or a 4 based on all the shit the government wastes money on, like blowing children up, okay? Right? Those are the things that go up about a 10. DEI initiatives in Malaysia go to a 10. This is a 3 or a 4, unless there's no road. Unless there's no road, or the road is the Vietnamese government paid two guys with a bulldozer to push a path through the woods and took $50 million American dollars to do it. Now, don't go look for that specific project, because I'm making that one up, but I bet you it's happened. Foreign aid is where we take money from poor people in America, the middle class and the lower middle class that are taxed out the butt relative to what they make, and we send it to rich people in foreign countries. That's what it is. When we spend all this money on initiatives in Africa and Asia and the Middle East and all these places, even the ones that sound benevolent, even the ones that sound, like, again, we can agree that maybe we shouldn't be spending money, but when you look at what we're spending the money on, you can at least understand why we might do that. But what about where it's not happening? How much of this money is never doing the thing? How much of the money for transgendered bullshit in South America or DEI in Malaysia just isn't actually happening either? See, no one asked that question because you don't really want it to happen. Right? But do you really think there's a huge demand in Malaysia for DEI training? Do you? Do you believe that? I don't believe that. Do you think there's a big demand for sex changes in Colombia? They're just people there, and not just, I know there's nutbags all over the world that want their beanbags cut off. I understand that. What I'm saying is if you went to Colombia and you talked to the average Colombian and said, what are the things in your life that are a problem that you wish your government, in combination with foreign aid from the United States, would address? So let's not pretend Colombians are all crazy. Right? Or they're all dealing friggin' cocaine. Colombia's a fairly poor country with some really nice places in it, by the way. But even in those nice places, there's a lot of people that are barely getting by, just like here. How many of those people do you think would be like, you know, if y'all could just help the poor people here who need a sex change and can't get one, my life would be better? I would think the average Colombian's probably just as outraged about money from the United States providing that service as they are about many as many of you are. Now, what if, though, when you look at it, like, what's the ratio of actual the end result with a terminal spend actually doing the terminal objective? Biden rolled out this multi-billion dollar plan to put electrical charging stations in, and they did two. They're like, you know, $45 billion apiece is what the cost was. Supposedly more are coming. We will see. They had over 2 years to do it. This shit isn't hard to do. The Albertsons up the road where I park at, the one nobody ever uses, by the way, put up a sign, EV vehicle charging station coming. 2 weeks later, there it was. It's not hard to put this shit in. You connect it to the grid, you put in the equipment, you turn it on, and you put a friggin' ATM front end to it so people can pay for their power. It's not hard to put these in. Where are they? We don't know. So if they'll grift money out of something that's for America, in America, that even if we don't really want it paid for that way, makes some utilitarian sense, what do you think they're doing with all this bullshit all over the world? Maybe all of this nonsensical money that they're spending, you know, maybe a program to fund research on transgender gerbils and say, what, NAO? Isn't even doing what it says? Maybe it was just like, how much money, like, literally think about this. If the agency's sucking up itself 60% overhead, the more money they spend, the more money they get. Maybe it got to a point where they had so much money to spend that some of these nonsensical things started getting funding because they had money that they couldn't get out the door, and we all know what happens then, don't we? Do we not know all that? Oh, see, I eventually ended up running a motor pool in the military, and I got a call one day from the captain, and the captain said, you have a lot of money in your budget. You need to spend it. And this is like right after Thanksgiving. I said, well, sir, I thought it was good that I had money in my budget. And he yelled at me and explained to me that if I didn't spend the money, that we wouldn't get the money again next year. So I bought a bunch of parts and shit we didn't need, put them in the storage lockers and all, and saved them. It probably made somebody's life hell a few years later when we had to leave Panama and they had all this extra inventory to get rid of. I know, we'll just give it to Panama like we gave Black Hawk helicopters and M-16s and everything else to the Taliban. The waste is insane. And there's no reason it wouldn't be. And that's what I want to end with today. Why would you expect anything else? You know, Guy Swan did a really great matrix of how spending works. It's a simple four-quadrant matrix. And one of the quadrants is you're spending your money on yourself. When you spend your money on yourself, you give a great deal of concern for quality and cost. You pay attention to both of those things. You want to get your money's worth. My money on me, I want my money's worth. Then when you're spending somebody else's money on you, okay, then you give a great concern for quality, but not so much for cost. You have the company credit card and an unlimited monthly budget for food, and you take a client out and you both order lobster thermidor and you get two servings for each of you. You take one to go because you don't really care about the cost. It's not your money. Well, your government lives in that quadrant all the time, spending your money on them. So they don't care about the cost, but they care about the quality of their own shit. But what happens? There's another quadrant. I'm spending my money on somebody else. When I spend my money on somebody else, I care a little bit about quality, I guess, but I'm really looking at cost. If I'm buying you food because you don't work, you're getting rice and beans. Quality shit, cost is low. I care about the cost more than the quality. But what happens when I'm spending your money on somebody else? I don't give a shit about cost, and I don't give a shit about quality. This is our government. Everything they do outside of for themselves, it's not their money. They didn't earn it. They didn't work for it. They didn't do anything for it, okay? And I know, well, they have jobs and they get a paycheck for that. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the money being managed for programs, you know, to examine the effects of racism on frogs or whatever. Why? It's like, if you cared at all, you'd say, wait a minute, hold on. I don't think frogs care about racism. But if it's not your money, and you're going to get your paycheck, and all you're going to do is rock the boat and potentially get demoted or lose the promotion by asking that question, you don't give a fuck. Paper come in, paper go out. Boom. We can't expect any better than what we have with the amount of money going in and the mandates and the incentives that government employees have. And it will never actually fix itself, and it will never actually get fixed. All it can be done is downsized for a time and expose enough of it as possible to get as many people as angry as possible, and it's going to take about 60% of people saying, absolutely no more. Not just going, I think that's wasteful and we should do more. Like, absolutely fuck all, no more. It will take at least 60%. I know a revolution can be started with 3%, but once you're fighting an established system in a democracy, which this country is, even though some of you special talk, it's a republic that we manage as a democracy. We are a constitutional republic in the form of a representative democracy. It takes a super majority of voters willing to break with party line, willing to break with tribalism to say absolutely, positively no more of this shit. And as bad as it is, and as much has been exposed, we're not even close to that yet. I know if you like, you're on X and all the people you follow are like people like me, you feel like, man, we just got it going on. We're the super majority. Yeah, well, there was like freaking 100,000 people or some shit in New York the other day, New York City, protesting cutting government spending on shit like we're talking about. You ain't a super majority, folks. That's why we do this show. That's why we talk about things like homesteading, growing your own food, and developing parallel economies and parallel networks. Because there is a suicidal bent to the systems running the world today. There really is. And empires always end in disaster, and this is an empire. The United States is an empire and has been for a long time, and that empire is coming to an end. When your empire is ending and you're in that empire, you need to start building your life as though you're already not an empire anymore. That's the only way to be prepared. That's the only way you can be prepared. You know, it's not like fire at home. The best way you can prepare for a fire at home is do all the things that you can so that the house doesn't burn down in the first place, and then have a redundancy plan if the house burns down. When it comes to the end of an empire, all you know is that the empire is going to end. It might end when you're dead, because you're gonna outlive it. You know, it'll outlive you, and a lot of people have, you know, died before the empire ended. The end of an empire can take 10 years. It can take 100 years. You just don't know. But you have to build your life as though you understand the empire is going to end. That doesn't mean total collapse. Doesn't mean, you know, Patriots succumbing collapse with James Wesley Rawls. It doesn't necessarily mean those things. It can. Often it just means you're not an empire anymore. The United Kingdom's not an empire anymore. You want to know what our future looks like at the end of empire, go look at the post-World War II economy in the United Kingdom from the 1950s to like now. There's been some upside to it here and there, but overall, it has been positively brutal, and then they went and embraced socialism on top of it. Don't think it can't happen here. Be prepared. Stay the course. Keep the powder dry. Stay prepared for the disaster that is short-term and acute, and stay aware of the disaster that is long-term and chronic, and we're sitting in the middle of it right now, the collapse of our currency. Well, the currency isn't going to collapse. Currency has collapsed. The currency's collapsed. It's already collapsed. Go look at what you could have bought for $5 in 1970 and look at what you can buy for $5 today and tell me it hasn't collapsed. It's collapsed. It's just been long and slow and drawn out, and people have been able to adapt to the collapse over time. But my dad, in the 1970s, working construction, made as much money as a general practice doctor by working about 80 hours a week and making half his money in overtime. In the 1990s, after I got out of the military, I basically did the same job my dad was doing. It was a different type of construction. It was construction work. I was doing at the same level he was at. I made about the same money he did in 1970. The currency's collapsed, and the empire is falling. You need to be prepared. With that, I hope you enjoyed today's week of show or this week's shows. I hope you've enjoyed this week of shows. It's been a challenging week for me. It's been one of those weeks where a lot of things have gone wrong. I've managed to keep the wheels on the show, and I'm ready for it to be over. I got some good news. I'm sure she's in the air right now, but Nicole Sauce is going to be here at her house for a few days. We're going to be working on a project together, and she'll be going home Sunday. She brought the cold weather in. That sucks, but it is what it is. And I'm looking forward to seeing her, and I'm going to get to see my buddy David this weekend. And my encouragement for you is find good people to spend your weekend with, and that will bring you Hard Charging back next Monday. We're going to be doing some cool shows next Monday. One of the shows we're going to do next Monday, I'm kicking around the idea of doing something we haven't done in a while, like take a single plant and talk about how valuable it is for homesteaders, even if it's not something that I eat a ton of. Like we did it with sorghum once. It's a great independence grain. I'm thinking sweet potatoes. You don't think I can make an hour show about sweet potatoes interesting? You don't know Jack then. And we're definitely going to do a show next week on Bitcoin called Bitcoin is Money. And we're going to talk about how a lot of the illusions, the arguments, the objections, including from Bitcoin enthusiasts, just all sound stupid when you simply accept the fact that Bitcoin is simply money. With that, I'll catch you guys tomorrow with a Friday flashback, and then we'll do it all over again next week. You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Revolution.